Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
How you doing? Welcome to the show. This week we are jam-packed with amazing guests, including Queen of the Clubs recording artist Martha Wash. Martha was a member of the Weather Girls, who are responsible for the super catchy song It's Raining Men. She also sang lead vocals for Black Box and CNC Music Factory before finding success as a solo artist. We also speak with Jill Zarin of the popular TV show The Real Housewives of New York, not to mention talking to fitness professional Matthew Young about keeping our kids fit during the school year.
Capture your need for sound.
Chances are, if you've been to a dance club in the last 25 plus years, you have gotten down to the sounds of the amazing and incomparable Martha Wash. As one half of the Weather Girls, she made everyone get on the dance floor with It's Raining Men, which has become a club anthem for decades now. She's also made us lose our minds singing with Black Box on Everybody, Everybody, I Don't Know Anybody Else, and Strike It Up. And did I happen to mention she turned it out with CNC Music Factory on Gonna Make You Sweat? This lady is simply the sound of the clubs and is also dominated with her own solo career with such hits as Carry On and Give It To You, as well as her latest single, I've Got You. Martha Wash, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much.
Martha, I have to ask you, as a child, did you know that you were going to be an entertainer?
I never knew that I was going to be an entertainer. I always knew that I was going to sing. I just didn't know in what capacity.
How did you actually get into singing? And then as you sort of progressed, how did you become part of, Two Tons of Fun with Izora Rhodes, and then which became the Weather Girls?
I started singing when I was about 3 years old. My mother, who loved to sing, really encouraged me as a child. And gospel music was the only music that was played in my house. So I grew up listening to a lot of gospel music and everything. And as time progressed all through school, I had music classes. And as far as singing professionally, it started when I was singing background for Sylvester. I went and auditioned for him. And he wanted another woman who was large like me and said, can you find her? You know, do you know anybody else? And I said, yes. And a couple of days later, I brought in Izora.
And what was it like becoming Two Tons of Fun?
It was fun. It really was fun because that was the beginning for me. And being a background singer, just learning about the business as far as being out there on stage and entertaining people and things like that.
And can I ask you, because I don't know if many people know the story, how you turned it into the Weather Girls?
The name change from Two Tons of Fun to the Weather Girls came about with the song It's Raining Men. In the beginning of the song, it says, hi, we're your Weather Girls. Well, when the song came out and it became such a big hit, people thought there was a new group out called the Weather Girls. Fans of Two Tons of Fun and people that knew our voices said, no, that's Martha and Izora. So it was a controversy going back and forth as to if it was a new group or not. And what we did was eventually change our names from Two Tons of Fun to the Weather Girls. We started a new recording contract with another record company and then moved from the West Coast to the East Coast.
And what was it like when you guys recorded It's Raining Men? Because this song has become like a club anthem. It's played at parties and weddings. Did you have any idea when you recorded it that it would become this staple for decades?
I didn't have a clue. We really, really laughed at Paul Jabbar, the guy who wrote the song. And he said, I want you to record this song. And we listened to it and just laughed and said, you got to be kidding. And he said, no, I really, really want you to record this song. Too many of the big stars had turned it down, like Barbra Streisand and Cher and Donna Summer and Diana Ross. They had all turned the song down. And he said, no, I know this song is going to be a hit. And so we went in a couple of days later. We finally relented and went in and recorded the song in about 90 minutes and walked out of the door and said, see you, Paul. And that was really basically how it started.
And now, like all these decades later, when you perform the song, does it still shock you to see how everyone goes crazy for it?
Yeah. Almost 30 years later, yes. But come to find out, it's one of those songs that everybody just likes dancing to or singing because there are grandparents out there that like the song, the parents like the song, the grandkids like the song. It's just one of those fun songs that everybody has to dance to and sing to, you know.
And when you sort of wrapped things up with the Weather Girls and then sort of went solo, if you want to call it that, did you, because you became this sought-after session singer, how did you start, or the projects come to you to work with Black Box and CNC Music Factory? Because I think a lot of young people, that's for the first time that they knew Martha Wash because of these two projects.
I'm trying to remember which one came first. I think it may have been Black Box. I was going to record some songs for this. They were basically studio musicians. They were under the name of Groove Melody. And I went and recorded these songs thinking that they were going to be demos for somebody else. What happened was they wound up putting all of the songs on a compilation album and calling it Black Box. And when the songs came out and then the videos came out, they had this woman, some model, lip syncing to my vocals. And that's what started the litigation process.
Which I actually want to ask you about, because I think, you know, especially for just regular folk who listen to music and were into maybe the bit of the dance scene back then, you know, when we would see these videos and it would be this big booming voice, and then, you know, specifically with the CNC Music Factory with Gonna Make You Sweat video, I believe it was Zelma Davis that they had.
Right.
So was that what sparked you, like, to prompted you to go to this litigation? Because, you know, other people were taking credit for what you were doing.
Yes, and for me, it was like false advertising to the public. They weren't getting what they were paying their money for, because they were looking at this video and listening to this music thinking there was this woman singing these songs, which was not true. I was the one that did the vocals for these songs. So in a way, it had to be corrected. And even with the false advertising aspect of it, they're just like they're taking their hands and grabbing the vocals out of my throat. And that's wrong. You're not supposed to do that. And to try and take credit for somebody else's work, that's in any kind of occupation. It just doesn't have to be music, you know. Somebody else takes the credit for the work that you've done. It's wrong.
And I have to ask you, was it a long, arduous process, Martha? Because I know that legal action can take a long time. Was it draining on you to go through this?
It was at that time, because it was something that I had never had to deal with before. So it was very upsetting for me, very just tiring. But in the end, it took almost a couple of years to settle the CNC Music Factory litigation. And after it was all settled, they came back and asked me to be a part of the group as far as recording a couple of more songs for their second project and being in their videos. So it all worked out.
And I have to ask you, because if I understand correctly, by the fact that you took initiative to deal with this situation, if I understand correctly, the music industry changed because of what you did. And if you can explain that, because I understand that now vocal credits are a must for music recording.
Well, with the help of my attorney, he was the one that I'd have to give him credit for, as far as some kind of statute in the law there, where it is mandatory that you have to give the person credit who does the work. Yes.
And now that that sort of obviously has been said and done for a long time, how do you feel about Black Box and CNC?
Black Box, I haven't heard anything from them in years. CNC Music Factory, I haven't really heard anything from them. I wish them well. It's been so long ago that, you know.
And obviously, I know that David Cole passed away, so I know for a while things were obviously not working. But I understand that actually Eric Cupper is now coming and is working with Clavelis, and they're supposed to be coming back with some interesting music.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know that.
Hopefully, Martha will be on there somewhere. Martha, now I have to move forward again to after those two projects. In 93, you released your first solo CD, Martha Wash. I'd have to ask you, what was it like to finally have your own CD out on the market with your name attached to it? And especially because it was so successful with you know, songs like Carry On, Run Around, and Give It to You.
It was a wonderful feeling, because RCA, in the final litigation with Black Box, RCA Records offered me a record deal. So that first solo CD was wonderful, as far as people knowing this is who I am, this is the music that I do, and remember the voice.
Joining us on the show right now is amazing recording artist and entertainer Martha Wash. Make sure to check her out, www.marthawash.com. Now, Martha, I have to ask you this. You have a massive gay following that are and you're constantly performing at gay community events. What does your gay fan base mean to you? Because I have to tell you that a few weeks ago, I had the great opportunity to speak with Cece Peniston, and she says that her gay fans, she calls them her best girlfriends.
I'd agree. I would agree. They have really kept me in the forefront of buying the music and being huge supporters of me, and it goes all the way back to singing with Sylvester. So it's been a love thing for many, many, many years.
And I'm assuming that you're kept incredibly busy by these events, because I know that I've seen you in Toronto, and I have to ask you, is it a bit of like a traveling circus? Because I know I've seen you, I've seen Cece Peniston, Crystal Waters. Are you girls all friends?
We know each other, and sometimes we've done shows with each other. I think I did the last show I did with Crystal was earlier this year, but sometimes we see each other because we don't always necessarily know who's on the same show with each other. So it's always nice when we happen to run into each other.
And I have to ask you, you know, you've worked with such incredible vocalists, Jocelyn Brown, Luther Vandross. First of all, I have to tell you, Keep On Jumping was amazing. I have to tell you that.
That was fun.
Who would you like to work with in a contemporary standpoint if you were to collaborate with anyone nowadays?
Ooh, contemporary right now, I'm not sure about. But I would say a little bit older, probably Aretha Franklin. I'd love to do something with her.
And what do you say to these young artists, Martha? Because, you know, you've been around for a while. You've seen the music industry change. What do you say to, you know, the Justin Biebers of the world and even, like, the younger singers that are coming up, like Adele? Obviously, she has great vocal power. Mm-hmm. But even the ones like Rihanna, who I think are sometimes more known for their songs than their vocal ability. What do you tell them to stay in this business?
Ooh. I think just keep going, keep a humble heart, and really keep a humble heart. Don't always believe all the hype, you know, because you can sometimes get lost in it, and try and stay true to yourself, whatever it is.
Yeah. And I'm assuming that this industry is not for the faint of heart.
Probably not. No. It's really a crazy business, and you have to be crazy to be in it.
And I guess with that too, what keeps you, and I'm assuming this, Martha, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's the performing that maybe keeps you in it.
Yeah, it does, because many times I had thought about really stopping and not going any more forward with the music, but I still keep doing it.
And with that, I remember in 2004, you started your own record label, Purple Rose Records. Has having your own label meant a lot of extra work for you?
Definitely, because usually with a record, a much bigger record label, they take care of all the other stuff and, you know, shell out the money. When you're more independent, it's a whole lot more that goes along with it, and you have to have the finances to do it and the people around you to do it and all that stuff. So it does take a lot more.
And do you actually actively seek out other talent, or is it mainly to support your efforts?
Mainly to support my efforts right now, but hopefully sometime in the future start looking for other artists.
And I know that you've been very involved in autism awareness. Can you tell us how you got involved in that and what that work involves?
I got involved with them because I did a talent show for this organization called CUSAC, which stands for Quality Services for the Autism Community. I did a talent show for them about a year ago, and I became interested in them when I saw all this huge talent that these young people and adults had. And I told him, or we talked about it, and he said, well, they would be a good fit for you, because at the time I was focused more on the adult side of autism. You always hear about children and autism, but you rarely hear about teenagers and adults with autism. And the thing is, you have to remember, the autistic child is going to grow up hopefully as an autistic adult. So that person needs just as much care, if not more, than the child. The organization that I deal with has such a comprehensive service dealing with early education for the child, all the way up to the adult and their needs. So that's kind of why I got involved with them. Although there is nobody in my family, no close friends that have autism, but since I've been doing more and more interviews, people have told me they have a family member or they have a close friend who has an autistic person in their family. So it keeps getting, the problem is, the growth is getting so large so quick, because one in every 110 children are going to be diagnosed with AIDS, and that's a bad margin. It used to be 1,000 like 20 years ago, but it's shrunk down to 110 right now. So I'm just kind of doing my part as another human being, somebody who's concerned about these people that need help, and being recognized as people who, when they become adults, can live within the community and live a life that is fulfilling for them and become progressive and successful people in their communities, as opposed to kind of shuffling them off into a corner somewhere.
Do you think society needs to be paying more attention to autism? Because I know it's gotten a lot more, I guess, press, if you want to call it that, in the last couple of years. But do you think people can be doing more?
I think so, especially raising funds, because government budgets have cut the funding for autism and stuff. So the organizations are not getting as much money as they need to keep these organizations open and to help as many people as possible. So I think it should be more funding for them. So that's why we go out, try and raise money. We're getting ready to do another Got Talent in a couple of months or so. So to keep the word going about people that need this help.
And if we switch gears again back to your career, Martha, where are you headed in the next 12 to 18 months? Because I'd heard rumors that you were going to work on a children's book.
I was going to work on a children's book, and I haven't forgotten about it. It's kind of put to the side for right now. But I'm working on my memoirs now. And also still in the studio, trying to finish up this CD. Still working on the road, traveling as much as possible, doing as many shows as possible. And just staying out there, being relevant.
And I have to ask you too, Martha, because you're traveling so much and you've been doing it for a while, does it get tiring, or are you still happy to be in your suitcase?
I think I'm more used to being in the suitcase than being at home, because after about 2 weeks, I'm saying, okay, where am I supposed to be going next? So I'm more used to being on the road than not.
And with regards to the CD, do you have any idea when it's going to be ready for us to take a listen to?
Hopefully by the first of the year.
Excellent. Martha, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much. Hi, this is Martha Wash, and you're listening to The Kelly Alexander Show.
The dome, back with the bass, the jam is live in effect, and I don't waste time on the mic with a dope rhyme. Jump to the rhythm, jump, jump to the rhythm, jump, and I'm here to combine beats and lyrics to make you shake your pants. Take a chance, come on and dance, guys, grab a girl, don't wait, make a twirl. It's your world and I'm just a squirrel trying to get a nut to move your butt to the dance floor. So yo, what's up? Hands in the air, come on, say yeah. Everybody over here, everybody over there, the crowd is live and I'm cool. This food, party people in the house, move. take a breath and go for yours. On my command, now hit the dance floor. It's gonna make you sweat till you bleed. Is that dope enough? Indeed, I paid the price to control the dice. I'm more precise, to the point I'm nice. The music takes control, your heart and soul unfold. Your body is free and behold. Dance so you can't dance, so you can't dance no more. Get on the floor and get raw. Dip, come back then upside down. Easy now, let me see you move.
My next guest is a real powerhouse on the hit show, The Real Housewives of New York. Jill Zarin has been on the program since the beginning and definitely fosters water cooler talk after each episode. And not only is Jill a Real Housewife of New York, but she's also a co-author of the book Secrets of a Jewish Mother and has launched two product lines, Jill Zarin Home Bedding and Squeeze Couture. Jill Zarin, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, Kelly. So great to be here.
Jill, I have to ask you, you have been on Real Housewives of New York since the beginning. How did you actually get cast on the show?
Wow, that's a long story. If you want, you can buy my book, Secrets of a Jewish Mother, or go online and read about it. But to make a long story short, they found me. The producer, Bravo, had decided they were going to do a show called Manhattan Moms, and they were casting for women with kids in New York City who lived the so-called fabulous life. And they saw my picture online on NewYorkSocialDiary.com at like a society party, and they called me, cold called me, and left me a message on my machine that they were calling. They were the producers of Super Nanny, that they were doing a new show about fabulous New York women and their families. Would I be interested? Call me, you know, and I called, and then I submitted a little bit of tape and went through the process, and they selected me, and then they asked me, do I have any friends, because it would be better and more organic if I came on as a group. So after many people they met, they chose Bethany, they chose Luann, and Ramona. They didn't meet directly through me, but indirectly through someone else I had recommended, then recommended her. They didn't take the person I recommended, but they loved Ramona. And Alex and Simon came through a different route. And there's our cast of five.
And with regards to the show, now I'm sure people ask you this all the time, but you know, how real is real?
Everything we say and do is real. The setups aren't always real. Sometimes things have to be filmed out of order, not to change storyline, but for practicality of things that get missed and for story continuity. Sometimes you have to just go back and say a few things to set the story in motion. And oftentimes, at the end of the season, after we're done filming, they're editing. And in the middle of editing, they find that they're missing pieces to the puzzle. Not things in the scenes, but verbal cues. Like, for example, so my friend invited me to this jewelry store for a party, and I ran into Luann. And that kind of thing, because they didn't have that in the scene, they needed to put it in later. And that's that talking head interview. So we do that later on in the season. After we've shot the season, we do it later on during editing. So there are things that aren't real, you know. Rarely do we do a scene after the fact. But I'll give you an example of one that we did do after the fact. When I went to The Island, which is airing now in Canada, season three, when I go to... I went to St. John to visit. I went to St. John, and afterwards, when I came home, I had to shoot a scene as if I hadn't gone yet, and I had to have lunch with Luann to set up why I went, why I was going. So it's like, you know what? I think I'm gonna go, and she's like, I don't think you should go. Now, of course, I went. So I'm like, well, I'm going anyway. It wouldn't have changed the fact, by the way. It's not like it would have influenced what happened, but there are things that are shot out of order. Rarely, though.
And with regards to the talking head interview, like when you have to do those parts after the fact, when you're sitting there talking, I guess, to the producers and getting that footage for them, do you ever have moments of regret or moments like, I should have said something when this was actually happening?
Yes, when the show's actually airing, I'm always, I should have said this, I should have done that. Even the reunion, we just finished airing season four's reunion. I wish I could go back and say things that I was talking to the television when it was airing. I should have said that. And sometimes I say I shouldn't have said that. I mean, I could give you, well, you know, you haven't seen season four yet. But there's some stuff, because that's fresh in my mind. There's some things that happened in the first episode of season four that I'm sorry I said. And I apologized at the reunion.
And with regards to the apologies, do you ever get upset with the media, the way sometimes they portray you, Jill? Like where you seem a little, like they make you seem a little bit like a bad person.
Well, I think a lot of that had to do with, network decisions and behind-the-scenes things that I don't have control over. And oftentimes, networks will do that, and they'll pin people against each other, or they'll play favorites with a particular character for whatever reason. Maybe they have an advertising opportunity for them. Maybe they're giving them a spin-off show. Whatever the reason is, and there's nothing you could do, and it's very, very frustrating. But I will say that season 4 was a better year for me, and Bravo let me come back honestly and come back and didn't over-edit me.
And the show now...
So in other words, what I said and did was my own fault.
Now, the show entering, I know, fifth season of taping. Looking back so far, what's been the biggest highlight and I guess the most challenging time of being on the show?
Oh my God, that's a long time span, and my brain's not that smart. I can't think back more than a few months. So the highlight of the last 5 years was watching my daughter grow up. In fact, and a highlight would be right now this week in Star Magazine in the U.S., there's a 5-page spread that I did with Ali on Back to School with Cindy, who's the new housewife who you haven't met yet because she's on season 4 and her 2 kids. But there's 3 pages out of the 5 of Ali and I, and it's priceless to have those photos. I mean, the memories are just incredible. And then the downside is the same, is exposing my family to situations that aren't always pleasant. I've pretty much shielded Allison from a lot of the media attention. I think I've done a really good job of that. But, you know, it still exposed her and made her famous by virtue of being my daughter, and she doesn't really like it. So I really shield her. I protect her.
And it feels like as the show has gone on through the seasons, it seems like all of the housewives are progressing and sort of learning through life's curves. What do you think you are learning as you head into season 5?
Well, I think what I learned in season 4, which is what you're watching right now, is to let things go and try not to hold a grudge. I think that's what I walked away from season 4 with. Unfortunately, the damage was done. And, you know, Bethany, who I was fighting with, just did not want to make up with me. And I can't control her. And I think if it was reverse, no matter what she did, I would have forgiven her. Because that's what real friends do. So I think that season 3 showed me that our friendship was never real. And that really hurt me deeply. And it took me a long time to recover from that.
So you guys don't talk right now, eh?
No, we don't.
Joining us on the show right now is Real Housewives of New York's Jill Zarin. Make sure to check her out, www.jillzarin.com. Now, Jill, during your time on the show, your business has taken off, and has it been difficult to devote, you know, ample time to all of your important pursuits?
Well, I say that you can have it all, but not always at the same time, or you can't do it all well. And now's my time to grow and grow my brand because Allison's off to college. So I've been focused full-time, working nonstop. My Squeeze Couture shapewear line is coming out September 15th in America at Lord & Taylor's. And then we'll be expanding to Macy's, possibly Dillard's, Bloomingdale's is looking at it, and some home shopping network television shows I'll be working with them as well. So that's really where I'm putting all my time and energy, is because I think there's a void in the market for women for shapewear, and I solved a lot of the problems. I think I did. It's not curing cancer, which is what we're here for this charity for, is to find money for that. But whatever I can do to help, feel good.
And in the next, because I can't even ask you 2 to 5 years from now, but in the next, 12 months to 18 months, where do you see yourself, Jill?
That's a good question. Bobby and I have made a concerted effort to travel. One of the places we're visiting, obviously, is Montreal. We're so excited. And after this, I have a trip scheduled for work for Florida. And then I'm heading to Europe for 2 weeks on a big ship on the world. And then I think I'm going to continue that. We're planning a safari in the spring. And I'm not sure where the show is going to fit into that. For me, they haven't asked any of us back yet. They're going to talk about that next week. I'm not really sure where I stand and what I want to do. But I know one thing, that I'm going to be working my butt off on my Squeeze Couture shapewear line. I'm working on a skincare line, a jewelry line, and all these other products, because my fans have really asked me to share with them what I've done, and why not? You know, it'll keep me busy, keep me out of trouble.
And I have to ask you, it would be remiss of me if I didn't ask you about your book, Secrets of a Jewish Mother, that you co-authored with your sister and your mom. First of all, what was it like writing with two people who are obviously very close to you? And also, do you see yourself doing another book?
Well, first, thank you for reminding me of that, because my sister, when she hears the show, is going to say, why didn't you say writing the book was the number one thing that changed your life? because my sister wrote a lot of the book. She took our stories, she took our family history, my sister's incredibly gifted, and she penned Secrets of a Jewish Mother with my mother and I, and, you know, putting in our 2 cents, or 3 cents. Will there be another book? I don't know if we have the time right now to do it, maybe in the future. My sister's working really hard on her radio show, The Live with Lisa Wexler Show, which you can get online. It's an incredible show. She talks about politics, current events, recently the hurricane, certainly in the Northeast, and she has a lot of authors on her show. So it's a very interesting talk show. Every day you turn it on, if you're in the car and you're commuting or whatever, you're going to learn something from my sister. So I would love to do something with her. And we're actually working with AOL, and we're going to have a webisode series on AOL next year. Details I can't give, but my sister and I will be doing a project together in the near future.
And Jill, finally, what do you tell your fans who, you know, watch you on Real Housewives of New York? What do you tell them about the real Jill Zarinek? I know you said real is real, but what do you want them to know?
Well, I think people just have to be less hateful, more forgiving, and don't throw stones at glass houses. And I think one of the things that attracts people to the show is they see in us things they don't like in themselves. The ugly in us is the ugly in everyone, sadly. And I don't think anybody's perfect. And I think it's easy to see, look at other people's problems and criticize them, because deep down, you know, you may have done it, or it's been done to you, or something in there pushed a button. Because the ones who really react to it are the ones who are probably affected most by whatever that is. Like, whereas someone like my husband, Bobby, not everything rolls off his back. He could care less about any of it. But I think women can be mean and catty, myself included sometimes. Who's perfect? Who's perfect? But that's what makes us different than men, you know? And that's what makes us moms, and that's what makes us, you know, we make our mistakes and we learn from them. And I think that's what we have to teach our kids, is that no one's perfect. And you have to own it and say you're sorry, you know? And if they don't accept it, it's on them.
Jill, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much.
That's Real Housewives of New York's Jill Zarin. Again, make sure to check her out, www.jillzarin.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
School is back in full swing, which means, unfortunately, some of the summer's outdoor activities are starting to wind down. That leaves us wondering, how can kids get the same amount of exercise they did this summer during the school year? Answering that question for us today is fitness professional Matthew Young, the founder of Innovative Fitness and 60 Minute Kids Club. He's also a fitness expert for Global Television. Matthew Young, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me back, Kelly.
Matthew, do you find that over summer vacation, kids actually become more fit?
I think there's more opportunity for them to get their exercise in, that's for sure, because there's more to do, and the with the weather, it's great, easier for them to get outside.
And now that things are sort of winding down and you know, kids are heading back to school, can you give any suggestions to parents to keep their child active at home as, you know, fall and winter approach?
Yes, absolutely. I think routine's the most important thing, and when everything else comes into play, like school and all their activities, it's really important that you establish a routine so that they keep the fitness going.
You know, I know in the summer there's a lot of times where kids are left to their own devices, and that could mean being sedentary. And then when they go back to school, they're kind of sedentary again, I would think, because they're sitting at their desk doing their schoolwork. Does that play a factor in the fact that there are kids that sort of stay sedentary throughout the year?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's a good point that kids, you know, when you're in the school and you're sitting at the desk, it's important for the kids to realize that they have to balance that out with at least 60 minutes of activity per day, too. And that activity can be anything from walking to school to cycling to playing. But again, going back to the point, it has to be organized. There has to be a plan in place for that to happen, to make sure that it does happen. When they're in the summertime, they can just go outside and play on their own, and it's very easy for parents to kind of get that happening and let that roll. When they're in school and they're in the routine, that can kind of slip by the wayside. So making sure that they're in the organized sports, or just even making sure that they're getting their own physical activity in is the key.
I want to talk to you about your program, 60 Minute Kids Club, in just a sec. But just with regards to teachers, you know, again, with these kids sitting there for hours on end doing their schoolwork, math, French, science, whatever it is it important, Matthew, because I've always wondered this, you know, you're asking a child, especially if it's, you know, someone in elementary school, to sort of sit there for many minutes at a time, not doing very much. Is it important for a teacher to maybe get the kids to just even stretch and move around, like, you know, once every 90 minutes or something, just to sort of clear their heads a little bit?
Absolutely. And I think you touched on a good point. And I mean, the attention span is only so long for kids in elementary school, and having them do an activity, whatever it is, and get moving is really going to enable them to be better focused and make sure that their attention is where it needs to be for the education curriculum.
And do you suggest, because I know there's certain teachers, for whatever reason, they decide to be a little bit more animated or active in the class. Do you suggest that more teachers sort of think a little bit outside the box and maybe, you know, because I remember when I was in school, I had a teacher who liked to play some instrumental music for us, depending on what we were doing. But it just seemed to, it wasn't distracting. It was not too high energy, but just enough to sort of keep us going. Do you think teachers should sort of think outside the box like that?
I mean, I totally agree. That's a loaded question because I love teachers that think outside the box. And I think, you know, they have to find the way that best suits the class that they have. I mean, we know girls and boys learn differently and are different. So it really depends on the class that the teachers have, but absolutely thinking outside the box is a great way to again keep the student centered at the task on the task at hand for a longer period of time. So totally agree that whether it's we're trying to get different senses and different stimulus with the end goal of making sure that we're maximizing the kid's day and maximizing the kid's learning. So, I mean, I think it's really dependent on the class that you have. If you've got a class that's high energy and a little bit rowdy, having them burn off some steam is probably a good thing. If you have a class that's having a really tough time focusing, then doing exercises and drills that can really center the focus is probably a good thing. So it's really up to the teachers to gauge the class that they have instead of, like you touched on, just doing the exact same thing year in and year out.
And something else that sort of came to mind is the fact that, you know, I know that as the years go on, it feels like kids at a younger age have more and more stress put on them to do well at school because, you know, it's more competitive to get into this school or that college or that university. So I feel like they have more stress than maybe we did. With regards to that, I feel like a good way to maybe alleviate some of that stress is movement. And I was wondering how you feel about that and if you agree that, you know, kids need to sort of burn off the stress and that physical activity for parents, it's important for them to have that.
It's a must, and you're right. There's lots of pressure to perform at higher levels, lots of pressure to bring home the great grades. We're seeing the physical activity elements being cut out of schools. The extracurricular after schools is being cut out of schools because of the overtime and you know, teachers wanting to just kind of do their job and getting less and less into the after school and volunteering the time after school. So it's really important that the parents get that in. I mean, the physical activity is something that's kind of gone back to the family. And basically, I think society's saying, you take care of this. You take care of this in your household. You take care of this for your kid. You take care of this for the after school programs. And we're going to concentrate on just the education. So completely agree with that point. And it really needs to be something that the families think about before and plan for before they go back into the school year.
And something else I think, Matthew, and I wanted your opinion on it as well, again, for families planning as kids go back to school, is school lunches. What is a good school lunch for kids who are, you know, who are active and participating in more activities?
Well, it's a good question, and again, that's the if we boil it back, I think the most important thing is making a lunch your kid's actually going to eat. So sitting down with your kid and explaining and educating them on what is in their lunch, why it's in their lunch, what their likes are, knowing what their likes are, knowing what their dislikes are. I'm a parent too, so the most frustrating thing is when a kid comes home and you look in their lunch bag and the entire lunch is still there. Lunch is so key because basically, what will happen as we get back into the school year, as we all know, it's a rush for breakfast. So parents are doing the whole cereal thing, thinking that that's a great start. Cereal is not a great start for breakfast. You want your biggest meal for a kid to be breakfast. There needs to be some protein. There needs to be some eggs. There needs to be some cottage cheese. There needs to be some really good protein-rich food because it's like filling up your car with gas. We can't send our kids to school on an empty tank and expect them to pay attention, expect them to learn, expect them to retain information, etc. You really got to set the day off right with a breakfast. And getting back to lunch, it's the same thing. So, you know, when our kids come home and they haven't eaten their lunch, that tells me that their learning has dropped off dramatically from 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock, and they probably got very little out of it. So when we're doing lunches, we want to do some things that are high energy. We want to stay away from all the processed food, although it's easy, and a lot of parents do. There, you know, in the old days, it was the cheese and crackers or it was something processed. We want to stay away from that stuff. We want to have the fruits. We want to have the vegetables. We want to have, you know, those are rich and simple sugars, but good sugars. We want to make sure we're having some kind of a sandwich that has some kind of a protein in it, and we want that lunch to be big. The for kids, the biggest meals should be during the day, in the morning and in the afternoon, and then you're kind of tapering it down at night. Instead, what happens is that we don't eat in the morning, we don't eat very much in the afternoon, and we have a massive dinner just before we go to bed, where all those calories can't be utilized. So another point on lunch is that we want to make sure that we're educating the kids on snacks. So we want them to eat at 10 o'clock, we want them to eat at 12 o'clock, we want them to eat at 3 o'clock. So when they get home, they have a snack. We want to have more meals throughout the day. So it's a really good point, and parents need to put a lot of time and energy into thinking about what does this lunch look like, and then they need to have the conversation with their kid on why it's important to eat that lunch.
And I'm glad you brought up the breakfast thing, Matthew, because I think that gets glossed over because, you know, it's always, you know, hell for leather in the morning when people are trying to get their kids up and going. And I understand that it's chaotic and, you know, they're trying to get them out the door. They're trying to get themselves out the door. But is the breakfast thing something that should be potentially, I don't know, sort of planned on the weekend, that you sort of have a goal for the weekend, you know what's going on, that you've stocked up on the weekend, so you know that you can make sure that your kids are having solid breakfasts for the week, and that you're giving them time to eat that breakfast?
Absolutely. And you know, the common excuse is there's no time in the morning. Just get up earlier. It's not that difficult. Just get up earlier, number one. Number two, have a plan, like you're saying. It's really easy. What we need to do is make it really easy for parents to think about what they're going to feed their kids for breakfast. And that just means, okay, for most parents, they just don't know what constitutes a great breakfast. So, again, we're going back to what's easy, what's quick. Grab yourself a bowl of cereal. So kids are going to school on a bowl of cereal, which is, you know, probably one of the least nutritious breakfasts that we can offer our kids. So, absolutely. There needs to be a lot of time planning in there. And again, with that planning comes the education to the kids, constant education on why. So this is why we're doing this. This is why we need this. And if we can get down there and get up early, you know, a lot of parents are always having these issues. Well, I got to get up so early. Well, just make that getting up time earlier and get downstairs and have that opportunity with your kids to model good behavior. If the kids see the parents scrambling around all the time, then they're going to end up scrambling around all the time. If the kids see the parents sitting down to a proper breakfast, you know, whether it's reading the paper or whether it's just even taking the 5 to 10 minutes to have the proper breakfast before they get on the road, then the kids are going to learn that habit too. So again, big emphasis on the parents and modeling that behavior.
And Matthew, I wanted to ask you too, because I feel like teenagers get lost in the shuffle in this. You know, I think parents, once their kid hits like 13, 14, they kind of feel like, well, they're old enough to know what they need to do. But I know when I was that age, I went through this stage where, and I don't know what it was, but I didn't want to eat breakfast. Like it made me sort of nauseous, especially because I had this sort of long bus ride ahead of me. But then when I was getting to school, then it was like buying this muffin that I don't think was great for me to begin with. And then like every you know, other of my friends was doing the same thing. So teenagers, like, I think they need to realize, because they are smart enough to know a bit better, but I think they need to realize that they're still growing too.
Absolutely. I mean, and the thing is, if you look at the difference between kids in the States and kids in Canada, kids in the States are massive. And the reason that they're massive is because they've got all this, they've been conditioned to eat. I mean, not a knock against the United States at all, but it kind of, if you go down there, it's about meal after meal after meal, what's next. And that's just an ingrained habit. Whereas in Canada, we're kind of a little bit less on the consumption and so picky on, you know, what are we going to eat. Teenagers and kids should be eating a lot of food, you know, and it can be good food. And for a kid, if you've got a kid that's active, you can put some things in there that may be higher on the sugar index to give them that little jolt of speed. I mean, obviously in moderation, but, you know, we're not just talking about having fruits and vegetables every single day. It's got to be fun for the kids too. It's got to be realistic. And, you know, we're going to do the 80-20 rule. Eight out of the 10 things that we put in our mouths are going to be from the good food groups, and two are going to be from the not-so-good food groups. But getting back to your question, from teenagers, it's super important because they're still growing. They're still developing. And, you know, for the mental acuity, they need to be eating foods and they need to be paying attention. And, you know, through the teenage years, they need to be paying more attention than less attention. You know, unplug yourselves from the iPods and all the cell phones and texting. Pay attention to what's going on in school and set ourselves up for success. And nutrition and fuel and proper fueling have a lot to do with that.
When kids come home from school, I know you mentioned having, you know, their snacks at 3 o'clock. Is it also important, Matthew, because, you know, they've been sort of seated at school throughout the day and hopefully they do have some sort of physical activity like a gym class or something like your program involves. But is it important when the kid gets home? Because I know when I was in high school, it was like I kind of wanted to sort of chill out in front of the TV for half an hour. Is it important that you sort of come home and get active right away, like sort of shake it off, like shake out the cobwebs a little and sort of get into that routine? Because I feel like you shouldn't maybe just come home and then be sedentary again until maybe going to, I don't know, like swimming practice at six.
You know what? It's a good point. And that's again, I would say that's child dependent or kid dependent on what kind of a day they've had. Sometimes it's really great to come home and just kind of just do nothing for a little while. Sometimes kids like to come home and get right into it. Again, it depends. If you, my answer would be if you know you're doing something at some point during the evening, early evening or late evening, then sure, come home, take a rest, and take the edge off, and just do something that you enjoy, so that it's not a have to. What we don't want to do is turn fitness and activity into a have to that kids don't look forward to doing. So, you know, my answer to that would be, as long as the kids are looking forward to doing some activity, it doesn't matter when it happens in the evening as much as it matters that it happens in the evening. For myself, it's great as a parent because I have the luxury of being home when the kids come home. So we get right into it. So we've had the conversation of when you get home, you know, you're going to relax for a little bit, and then we're going to go and we're going to do something. So we're going to do an hour of physical activity that I'm there with, in addition to whatever else they've done during the day. They've got that hour. So we've built it into a routine. Now that routine can happen, you know, right when it's convenient for the parents. It can happen when it's convenient for the kids that are doing extracurricular stuff, whether their karate starts at 5 or their soccer starts at 6. It can be whenever that is. But for us, it works right after they get home from school because I've got their attention. I know they're excited and I know they want to blow off some steam. So I can do that and mitigate the two boys fighting, you know, for hours on end as soon as they walk into the door.
And just a question, Matthew, with regards to your kids, in the winter, do you find it like more difficult to get them active or is it just like put on your snow pants? And I know you're in British Columbia, but I'm assuming that the weather can get a little bit crazy there too. So is it harder for you to get them out or you've made a plan and they know that they're sticking to it?
You know what? It's all about making that plan. And I'm from Fenland Falls, Ontario, which is Northern Ontario. I know what it's like to have the cold temperatures. We got to stop using that as an excuse because, you know, the more we tell kids that it's too cold to go outside, the more that they will use that as an excuse. As you know, when we were all young, we heard the dreaded words, get outside. And we got outside. And, you know, whether it's making snow forts or doing something in the snow or doing something active, there's lots of great winter sports that can be done. There's lots of fantastic facilities, rec centers, et cetera, that we can go to. There's lots of things that we can do to be active outside, even in the winter months. We can't use that as an excuse, especially in you know, Eastern Canada, where it can get cold and that can be a potential barrier for a longer period of time. There's lots of stuff to do, getting outside, walking. And what we have to do is educate our kids on all the things that there are to do, how to do them, and set it up so that it gets done. And make it fun.
Joining us is founder of 60 Minute Kids Club, Matthew Young. Make sure to check him out, www.60minutekidsclub.com. Now, Matthew, for those who don't know, can you give us an overview of what 60 Minute Kids Club is? And have you made any significant changes to the program for this upcoming school year?
Yes, we have. So 60 Minute Kids Club is basically a platform that provides incentives, accountability, and follow-up to activity and exercise for kids. It's a school-based program, so basically our objective is to get schools involved because that's where we can get the most amount of kids and impact it. We want kids to see other kids and their schools being involved. We put in a friendly challenge. So basically what happens is you're just coming home and you're logging in your activities. You're logging in your activities, you're logging in your water, you're logging in your nutrition, and basically you're being accountable for the physical activity pursuits that you've done over the day. We found it super effective because a couple things. Number one, you know, there's a grand prize at the end. So basically, every single kid who logs in and submits what they've done during the day, that translates into points. So if you drink X amount of water, you get points. If you do X amount of activity, you get points. You get points for everything that you do. Those points go back in to your school and contribute to your school score. So at the end of the 60-day period, we tabulate the school score, and we know where your school stands. Super effective, great at bringing people together, and really important for that those kids that may not be self-motivated, self-starters, or the stars on their basketball, volleyball, track teams. This is really for the kids that are kind of could get lost in the shuffle and may not stay with physical activity as they go through elementary school. So what we're trying to do is give them the tool sets, the incentive, the motivation to get involved, track their activity, activity being skipping rope, walking to school, biking, cycling. We want to get them to think about that. And then when they come home, we're using the medium that they love, which is the computer, to log that. Again, it's a portal. You just come in, you log in your stats, and you get out. There's nothing there to keep the kids engaged, to keep them on. It's not a video game. It's none of that. So what we found is it's been very, very successful because it gives kids the appetite for physical activity, for knowing what a good breakfast was, for knowing what a good sleep was. And we're running the contest all year this year. Last year, we only ran it for 60 days at a time because we want to have a defined start period and a defined stop period. 60 days is a good manageable chunk for a young student. We're running it from October 15th to December 15th. We'll give the kids a couple weeks off for Christmas break. We'll pick it up again January 15th, run it to March 15th. Kids get March break, and then we're going to pick it up April 2nd and run it to June 2nd. So there's three 60-minute periods throughout the school year. Grand prizes have included, trips to the Vancouver Aquarium, for example, trips to the TELUS World of Science in Toronto, for example. And basically, we want to start this, fitness revolution and make this, use the 60-minute kids club as a tool to engage kids into activity right from an early age.
Now, I know your program is getting more and more people involved, and I know you're getting more corporate support, TELUS, on board this year. Intend to take the program in the next, 18 months to 2 years?
Okay, so the goal for this year, what we want to do, because there's a cost to having the kids be on the site and managing that interaction on the site, because there's a cost to that, what we're trying to do is get the sponsorship to cover as much cost as we can. And again, you mentioned we've got a great partner in TELUS this year. So last year we had kids from Nova Scotia, Ontario, and British Columbia all competing, and we had probably about 5,000 students. This year we're opening it up, we're having 15,000 students, and we're concentrating it on BC and Ontario to start, and then each subsequent year we're going to be adding two provinces, until we've got all kids in Canada covered. We're really looking for corporate sponsorship and help to get as many kids covered for free as possible. We don't want money to be the barrier. A lot of the other provinces that we deal with have come on and said, well, what if our school pays? That's fine. The school can pay. We still want to convert that into not having the school pay and not having that cost. Now, the cost isn't big. It's $5 per kid per year to have a membership in the 60-Minute Kids Club. So we're not talking about something that's exorbitant. It's a not-for-profit. That money is going back into prizing. That money is going back into web development. That money is going back into getting ambassadors out to the schools. So it's not a big Facebook money-making adventure. We are really trying to put as many kids in front of this as get as much incentive as we possibly can to make sure that this sticks, unlike a lot of the other programs that have gone into schools, the millions of other great programs that have gone into schools, but they've lacked some of the key, what we call the key anchors and incentive follow-up and accountability that this program can offer.
And if people want to get involved, Matthew, or learn more about it, where do they go find out all this information?
Well, they can go to the 60-Minute Kids Club site, or they can contact myself, matt@innovativefitness.com.
Matt, thank you so much for all of your wonderful advice. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks for having us on.
That was Matthew Young, fitness expert and founder of 60 Minute Kids Club. Please check out his website, www.60minkidsclub.com. That's www.60minkidsclub.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show this week, and I must give a shout out to my wonderful guests. And again, trying to leave you in a positive frame of mind for the week ahead, your quote of the week from former NBA superstar Larry Bird: I've got a theory that if you give 100% all of the time, somehow things will work out in the end. There you go. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.